This is Tim McHenry, producer of the Rubin Museum of Art, and you are listening to the Red Book Dialogues on WNYC's Talk to Me series.
I think one of the most important things in the development of Jung's thought that came out of the 16-year process that eventuated in the Red Book has to do with this question of madness. And as many of you know, prior to the outbreak of World War I, he had visions of a bloodbath in throughout Europe and a terrible cataclysm. And at some points he thought he was going mad, but when he realized that indeed there was a resonance between outer reality and what was coming up spontaneously in his own internal fantasy life, He shifted to that mode of himself, which was very much the scientist. And you see in the development of the Red Book multiple layers. One of them has to do with his primary experience of his own psyche. Another has to do with that voice of the scientist, where he abstracts principles and theoretical ideas, and these are written in the commentaries. A third layer is expressed in the artwork. Well, he wouldn't say artwork. He always objected to that. So let's say the illustrations, the drawings. And they're only tangentially related. It's not that the illustrations are in direct correlation to either the personal fantasies or the abstracted ideas in the commentaries. They have more or less degrees of overlap. There's also some thought that his building of the Bollingen Towers and his artwork there and at Küssnacht comprised a fourth book of the Liber Novus. And we could even say that his later ideas, which codified the seeds of this early work, yet another work, another book. So to turn to you, one other thing I wanted to say about that. Jung made a very strong distinction between the early forms of psychotherapy, which basically viewed psychotherapy through the model of pathology. And the what was spoken of at that time as the loosening of the phylogenetic layers of the psyche was basically thought of as equivalent to schizophrenia. And Jung, through the course of the work on the Red Book, came to see these mythological fantasies as very much expressive of something that could either go in a destructive direction or a creative direction. And Jung, over the 16-year period when the Liber Novus was primarily written and drawn, in fact, made very strong distinctions about and was very much willing to work at the edge of his own process, the edge sometimes he felt of madness, and at the same time work to find a relationship to it. Much later, in correspondence with James Joyce, Joyce asked him what the difference between he himself, Joyce, and his daughter, who was in fact schizophrenic, was. And Jung wrote back to him that the difference was that he had a relationship to it. And of course, that typified Jung's relationship to his own process at the edge of sometimes of madness as well. I think the primary thing that we can take from that in terms of our own individual processes, and certainly as an analyst in working, having the privilege and responsibility of working with individuals, is to focus on the degree of the ability to stand in relationship to these processes at the edge. And it's really about the having a vital relationship to those processes. And that makes me think of something you're quoted as saying, which is that you view your pieces as having a quality of life unto themselves, and a quality that is organic. And I don't remember where you are quoted as saying that. It's in the May book. Mm-hmm. That doesn't resonate. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyway, let's turn to the picture. So here it is.
This is sort of like the old Groucho Marx show. Remember they had the secret word, but the contestant couldn't see it, so I'm dying to see it. Ah, okay, great. So I'm going to now intuit. Well, I've actually seen this. I took a peek at the book, and it's interesting because this is one of the ones that I locked onto, which
really?
you can tell me why that might be. I'm going to be really honest and say, first of all, and I hope this doesn't make you think that I'm painfully art historical, which I'm not, but I thought first of Matisse because it reminds me of one of my favorite paintings, which, of course, is the very well-known Matisse dance. And I think why that appeals to me and why I probably locked into this, aside from the colors, and it was the idea that there are gestures, which is what dance is about in a sense. Dance is the magnification of human gesture, and those of us who just in normal life simply do things. We say things, we move, our voices have music within a certain range, in the sense that when I speak to you, certain words that are important have emphasis. So in a sense, the arts are these hieratic, elevated expressions of ordinary human activity. And I see this figure, and I'm first reminded of how it has a certain kind of iconographic gesture to it, and that's probably why it reminded me of the dance. Now, somebody else would see the snake right off the bat, probably the Freudians. Well, one of the things that comes to my mind is my son, who, when he was a little boy, used to love to draw mazes, and particularly used to love to draw maps of imaginary cities. Mm-hmm. And they did look like this maze in the background. And I'm reminded of the fact that Jung did this extraordinary thing, because, you know, first of all, he belonged to a very, very proper society, very proper. I mean, the German side of Switzerland is just so focused and so controlled. I don't know if you've gone hiking there, but I remember going hiking there and once stepping off the path and being chewed out by a farmer for not staying on the path. And then I noticed that the trash had been wrapped absolutely neatly to, you know, make the Japanese look like slobs. So we have to realize that Jung came from this culture of extreme control, psychic control. And what he did that was so brave and so courageous was that he found the little boy in himself, like my son. Mm-hmm. He was able to go back. I think the term used, I think, is active imagination.
Yes.
And enter this world, which some people would claim for art, and a lot of us wouldn't dare go there because, well, I'm an adult. I'm a grown-up, a rational person. I'm not going to start painting at the age of 30 or the age of 50 or something like that. And he wasn't afraid to go there and explore not only his psyche, but also his artistic, creative self. And I see that so strongly here.
What do you see in the gesture?
What do I see?
In the gesture.
It's not a gesture of pain. I mean, the figure is receiving something. I mean, it's like a laser beam. It reminds me of some medieval paintings I've seen where Christ or a saint would receive a stigmata, and the stigmata would come as a beam of light, and pass right through the hand. Mm-hmm. I suppose one could see the light coming from this figure's heart, but I see it as going to the heart.
Where do you see it coming from? Where or what?
Oh, it's coming from the outside, from the other world. Another sphere.
Do you see the figure?
I do see the figure. You mean the one on the left?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
The spear.
It seems to be passing through
thrower,
the figure's head. Yeah. It could almost be an angelic figure. I see some other figures, some eyes in the background. I also see vegetation. I see sperms, spermatozoa. I see bird beaks and wings. Trees, eggs. That ought to be enough to satisfy a Jungian.
That's just step one, John. There's an old text that Jung explicates called Visions of Zosimos, mm-hmm. and it starts with the line, "For there came one at early morn who pierced me through." Uh-huh. Who dismembered me in accordance with the law of harmony.
Beautiful. I can go for that.
Yeah. But I find, one of the things I find very interesting about this picture, and I think probably the thing that most drew me, was this a sense of the relationship of figure to ground, where at first you don't really quite see the light spear thrower. And of course, Jung talks a lot about paradox and the relationship between the thing that actually uses a phrase, the paradoxically existent, non-existent. So in a sense, it's like that thing that pierces one through isn't really quite there until it's subjected to process.
Mm-hmm. Well, the gesture is very much like paintings of St. George slaying the dragon.
Yes, where something. So you're seeing the.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it now as a spear. I hadn't noticed the hand, but clearly the area where this golden rod or beam of light or laser beam is broken is where the hand is. But I still like my first impression, which is less painful.
Yes. Well, one thing about Jung and pain is that, well, he certainly wasn't a stranger to it, but his one of the primary ways he changed psychotherapy was by being able to look at the painful, dysfunctional parts of pathology, but also looking at the progressive aspect. Mm-hmm. And I think we do get that in this kind of image. You know, if something's not broken into, it kind of stays in a static position. Doesn't open up to creative process.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. From my point of view as a musician, I owe a lot to Jung. I read him at a very critical point in my development as a composer, and you know, I've lived with Jung in the house all my life because my wife has been very deeply involved in it and continues to be. But I have to say that he was absolutely tone deaf. There is almost no reference to music in all of the gigantic body
That's right.
of work. The guy absolutely did not respond to music.
That's true.
He just didn't talk about it. And that's just amazing. Somebody from the Germanic tradition who didn't absolutely love that music. I mean, I think he mentions Wagner once or twice, but it's basically from a mythological point of view. And I don't think that actually Freud talks a great deal about music either.
Not a lot.
So I wonder what that means.
Yeah, and in other ways he was so protean.
Yeah, especially given that music is the art of feeling. I mean, Jung talks about feeling and, you know, feeling tone and feeling function and how important it is. And yet music, which is the art form of feeling, it's the ne plus ultra art form of feeling, is this one art form that he seems to be anesthetized to. I mean, he's obviously a very visual person. And I probably am not a very visual person. My father was a painter. My daughter's a painter, but it's, you know, that I seem to have fallen into the other category in between them. But do you have a feeling about that?
I don't really. I'm curious though. Does music have a visual component for you?
Yes, it does, but not to the extent that I see colors or like the French composer Olivier Messiaen, who when he hears a certain tonality sees a color. Absolutely not. I see images when I'm composing, but I don't think that they're particularly stirring or shockingly original images. I mean, the image that you read about, you know, that launched that particular piece, that was a dream image, but I don't have vivid, wildly fantastic images going on in my head when I'm composing.
You know, of course, as a musician, and I suppose most musicians, I think, have such a different relationship to music than the rest of us. I mean, as a someone who is a great music lover myself, but you know, feel really I don't really know anything about music, and it has so much to do with feeling level. But I always wonder if for somebody like you. And musicians in general, if there isn't some other mode of apprehension that is so radically different that it's almost incomprehensible to a non-musician.
Well, we like to make you think that, but I really seriously think it's just a matter of degree. I really do.
Truly?
I think people develop their perceptions through knowledge and through practice and through exposure. And, you know, I think I've devoted so much of my life to music that I probably shortchanged, you know, my visual education or my visual sensibility. I can't imagine that there are people that don't respond to music, although I think maybe Jung didn't. But I think that most people do. And with children, I mean, one of the great things about having children and being with them and watching them grow is that you see how polymorphous they are, how at the age of 3 or 4 or 5, they can do everything, and they're interested in everything, and they want to express themselves. And, you know, eventually as they grow, their interests tend to, you know, shunt to one side to another. But I think that we're all born with a native capacity to absorb and to be sensitive to all different kinds of stimuli. And I don't think somebody who's musical is some exceptional being. I think it's just somebody who's developed that tendency.
What role do you think the body has in your personal relationship to music?
What role do I think the body has? Well, I think that we feel music as a total experience. We feel it as an intellectual experience. I mean, you hear lots of talk, and of course you've experienced yourself about the intellectual pleasures of music. And that's why people love Bach so much, because Bach satisfies on so many levels, but probably, you know, the top two levels on which he satisfies are one of balance, of this just this beautiful sense of presenting images in time and images in sound and having them be so beautifully integrated and balanced. And the other is just this kind of sense of intellectual beauty. But there are other ways to experience music. Go to a hip-hop event, or go to a rave concert, or go to, you know, a Mahler performance and be swept away and just feel it in your gut, where music, you know, you're responding to really to almost the physical, the brute physical stimuli, you know, the pounding of a pulse. And, you know, we could go off very easily into a discussion about what the pathology of 20th century music, you know, what happened, why audiences had a problem with so much contemporary dissonant music. And I think that there are psychological and physiological reasons for that. But I think that as far as the role of the body goes, music is an all-encompassing art form. It involves you on every imaginable level. And that may be one of the reasons why when people are upset at a concert, they're far more upset than they are at an art museum. You know, I've been in an art museum and I've seen something is just positively disgusting, and people will look at it and see what the price is and look and then go on to the next one. But here's something in a concert and people are sitting next to you, they're just out of their minds and have to leave the room because they're so upset.
Well, certainly you've had that experience with a number of your pieces. Klinghoffer certainly aroused
that was different.
Extremely difficult emotion.
Yeah, but I have sat next to somebody who didn't know the composer was next to him. And, you know, I've seen the palpable anxiety that a person has with certain kinds of music. And, you know, my music, when it was new back in the 80s, a lot of people were made very uncomfortable by it. It was uncomfortable for them because there was a lot of very raw pulsation. And other people who had been trained to think of contemporary music as a very cerebral event were made uncomfortable by my music because my music was so overtly emotional.
Do you think it could have anything to do with the way you combine opposites? I'm thinking of something I read about you. There, you were cited as saying, describing how you were sitting at your desk listening to Schoenberg's Chambers symphony, and at the same time you could hear your son in an adjacent room listening to 50s cartoons, and you started to hear the commonalities?
Yeah, I think that a good creative artist needs always to be very playful. And the worst thing you can do is take yourself seriously. And I think that's one of the real pathological problems of modernism, is that modernism became, first of all, it became a tradition of non-tradition. You divorced yourself from tradition. Tradition was bad. You didn't have any real value unless you broke the rules. You had to be a hero. I mean, go see that movie where Ed Harris plays Jackson Pollock. That's a perfect summation of what we like to think of the hero artist, the person who doesn't follow any traditional discourse. And I think that, you know, at the beginning, that was a very useful and productive posture, a way of doing art. But I think that it became an ideology in many of the arts, not just in painting and sculpture, but in music and even in literature. And it finally produced, for me, what was sterility and mannerism and intellectualism, and more than anything else, a sense of deadly seriousness. And I think the great artists are very playful people who pick up a stimuli. And the stimuli could be anything. I mean, look at Robert Rauschenberg's just picking up, you know, debris and putting it, you know, fixing it on a canvas, and suddenly you realize that that debris that he's got up there is an expression of what our lives are. You know, that's this, it's the piece of trash that we suddenly realize is an icon. And I'm a little bit like that orally. I hear things, and it might be a rhythm from a pop song, or it might be a chord change from, who knows, some composer from the 19th century or the 14th century. And I process them. And I've always said I've been a composer with a loose filter. You know, that I think of a modernist as being a person with a very tight filter. You know, no, not that. No, that's been done. No, not that. No, not that. Not that. Maybe that. Whereas I'm more like, well, come on in. Come on in. inviting things in, you know, that's why I love Walt Whitman, for example. That Whitman,
well, you know,
was
that,
so
that comes across very much in your music and in your writings, and it's interesting because from a Jungian perspective, I would look at that not so much as in the not this not the opposite of that, but rather that this incredible inclusivity, mm-hmm. and looking at your listening to your music and reading various articles about you, it seems like that's really one of the things you have in common with Jung, that there is this incredible thrust toward a commodious state of being, and that you would just, you're just hungry to take in anything and everything. But then within that, there seems to be, again, from a Jungian perspective, it's not what I hear you saying at all, but from a Jungian perspective, it seems like what you're doing is making links between disparate things. Well, Jung talks a lot about the reconciling third.
Mm-hmm.
And musically, I can't really hear if there is technically a reconciling third, but I can certainly hear, like in, I was looking at the ceiling and then I saw the sky, which is the title is taken from a quote from a woman, what a woman said about her experience of an earthquake. But in the description of it, it says it's written in a way that's that appeals both to opera goers and to MTV watchers. And so it seems like there's this amazing thing, the way, like in the instance with the cartoons in the Schoenberg, hearing it in the pieces themselves and making the links, but also in terms of how you face out to the audience.
Yeah. Well, I said that I was hoping to make a piece that would appeal to opera goers and MTV watchers, and I found out it didn't appeal to any of them, but, you know, that happens. You know, what I really admire about Jung is that he chronicled his thought processes, and in that sense he was an artist. You know, I mean, if you look at his collected works, it's just mind-boggling how much he wrote during a lifetime. I mean, he was active right up into his 80s, but it's still staggering. And all of these books and papers and articles are so carefully written and so you know, proofread, and it's Wagnerian in its scope. And he's a little bit like Balzac that way. You know, Balzac once said that he wasn't an artist, he was just a recorder. You know, that he viewed himself as simply like a secretary. He's society's secretary. You said that, and you said that, and that house looked like that. And, you know, Balzac just goes on and on and on, but you just love that aspect about him because you really can feel what it was like to be alive in Paris and walk down some dirty back street and go into some pathetic rooming house where there are a collection of strange characters. And Jung was very much like that. I mean, he was not quite as passive as Balzac was in terms of recording, but he made of his writing a kind of creative record of his spiritual as well as his sensual experience. And in that sense, you know, I do think it's a kind of artistic thing that he did.
I think it's hard to deny.
Yeah.
Although he was making a point.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just have a few minutes, so let's turn back to the image. See if you have any further thoughts about that.
Hmm. Well, the fellow has a turban on. I haven't commented on that because I've already gotten into enough trouble with issues having to do with turbans. But I wonder why that person... Do you think he has a turban? Or is that a halo? Please tell me.
I have no idea if it's a turban or a halo.
Uh-huh. It doesn't look like a turban to you?
It looks a bit stylized.
I think I've just been
like
watching the news too much. Okay.
I mean, I think it's hard even to tell gender. You could see the facial as facial hair or not. It could be male figure, female figure.
Yeah, that's very presumptuous of me, isn't it? Well, I don't know. I don't think I'd be a very good client for you. I don't respond to it in, you know, in like an earth-shattering way. But obviously I'm suppressing something.
Well, we could always analyze the defense.
Okay. When's my next appointment?
I think it is an immensely rich drawing. And interestingly, because we haven't really gotten into the image that much, but I think, again, from a Jungian perspective, it bears a lot of relationship to the structures and dynamics of your music. But...
you know, one thing, I'm looking at it, I can say what I view as the angel, the St. George,
mm-hmm.
It does look like stained glass, medieval stained glass. And that reminds me... Of how Jung found the magic and the numinous in European culture which I think in the 19th century had become largely romanticized. You know, if you read the literature and the poetry and look at pre-Raphaelite painting, the view of that more mysterious epoch in European culture, you know, the Middle Ages and Christianity and the period of let's say, the first millennium, I think it had become made banal in the 19th century, that the Industrial Revolution couldn't deal with it, and so they turned it into kitsch, which we certainly see in, like, Dante Rossetti, for example. And Jung, you know, he took alchemy very seriously. Yes, nobody took alchemy seriously. And I think that may have been one of the reasons why Freud was taken so seriously by intellectuals, particularly here in the United States, because Freud was a scientist. And Jung, I think people really thought he was a wacko.
I think so, too. I mean, that's primarily why I made those prefatory remarks, because he was very much a scientist, and he thought of himself as very much a scientist, yeah. But he was also willing to use his own psyche and his own experience, both with himself and his patients, as a kind of experiment to and to really live at the edge and to then work scientifically to abstract principles from that and to develop methodologies.